colleges cannot give drugs to people. Well, Mr. Evison now is teamed up with Scott, and they got this little thing going here, and now they're going to experiment on people with LSD, which was the drug that the CIA was using at that time. It was very popular, you know, because what they were doing is trying to create Manchurian candidates so they could use people like us, damaged people from the world, and hypnotize us and brainwash us and mind control us and send us out into the world to do their stuff. We would be collateral damage. I know that now. Remember, I didn't know it then. So they targeted me, and they put me in a research program where they used healthy people as the model, as the guinea pig for the guinea pigs. Now, their excuses on paper, the stuff on paper says that they were using LSD for alcoholism, to curb alcoholism, schizophrenia, and drug addiction.
Smoking.
And smoking. I was none of the above. I didn't fall into that. Okay? On my assessment, Dr. Scott even says that I was highly intelligent and fairly gifted. Why would you want to do this to me? Here's the whys. Why? Why would you want to do this to me? I also know in my research that they were targeting people of color because we were disposable. And we were in bed with the Americans in the experiments, right? Now, I'm in the hole for 52 days, bread and water. So Evesen comes down, probably I'm in there maybe about 10, 20 days. And he comes down there with a student from Queen's University, a psych student from Queen's University. And he says, well, I'm going to help you. Pill. Get out of here. There was a hole in the middle of the floor. It's a hole. It's like a Bastille. I mean, you just imagine. And it's the cell I was in, there was a hole in the middle of the floor where you can go to the bathroom. Not a toilet, not a commode. Some of the cells had it, this one didn't. It had backed up. The floor was covered with human waste. I had been in this for over 10 days. Food deprivation. Yeah, we're going to get through this. And to keep dry, and I was soaked, right? You know, the little things you got on. So I used to, I don't know how many of you know what a cell is. I hope nobody does, but I'm sure someone does. Well, the bars come this way, and then you've got your cross bars. So I would try to dry myself up a little bit, and I would get up, put my feet, you know, through the bars, like sideways, and hold on like this, and hold back like a monkey in a cage, right? Trying to dry myself up enough, but you could never, because you can't hang like that long enough. And then you get back and you sit down. So now I am an animal. I am in an animal state. State of mind, sensory deprivation, the other drugs that they were giving me, starvation, it's called restricted diet. And I wasn't trying to lose any weight, trust me. And so here comes, this is the environment that I was in when they gave me LSD. And then I lost my mind. They gave me LSD and they didn't let me out. So I'm going on a trip without my luggage. Gotta laugh. So I'm going on this trip and there I am. There I am. Tripping. Nobody explained anything to me. I didn't know what to expect. Bars were turning into snakes. Walls were coming in at me like this. The ceiling was coming down on me. And I was screaming, but nothing was coming. I was dry screaming, you know? So they left me like that, I guess, for a couple of days or something. And then they came and they got me out. So, can I have some water, please? Can I make it? Don't you do it. Thank you.
Did you find your
Great.
Yeah, that one's gone, okay?
Hi, guys. Thanks. And is someone watching the time? Okay, so I'm just going to go to some written text now because I think it's easier for me. Thank you.
Here's some more.
I'm going to talk a little bit about ethics, something that CSC doesn't seem to know anything about, or a lot of justice. Ethics. I know that learning is an ongoing exercise. Hopefully we take this opportunity and privilege to our graves. Some of us acquire our knowledge through unconventional ways, life experiences, observations, listening, doing, doing to, doing against, and being done unto. Combined with strength of character, common sense, compassion, and healthy instincts, we should come to a place of reason, enlightenment, and a civilized standard of right and wrong. Also, good old-fashioned mother wit can carry the day. Therefore, ethics should be an automatic state of grace among all people of conscience, not a scientific discipline, and certainly should be expected from those in a position of power and authority. Imagine my surprise when CSC, Correctional Services of Canada, contracted the McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law to tell them if experimenting on inmates of a total institution was ethical or not. At the cost of over $100,000 of your tax money. Now remember what was done to me and other prisoners in 1960, if any of you are of the age, was done in your name, and what is being done to me and other prisoners who are taking the government on and who are in this litigation, and the re-victimization of us is being done in your name. You don't know nothing about it, do you? Mm-mm. Well, I'm going to tell you. Of the taxpayers' money. I and my legal team had already found the necessary documents proving that the Department of Corrections blatantly and with total disregard violated the Nuremberg Code. Because of what happened with the German medical profession, a Nuremberg Code was created and endorsed for international adoption in the late 1940s. We signed it in 48, the Americans signed it in 47, we signed it into policy at the federal level in 1950, and I am being experimented on in 1960 to 63. Its clauses were refined by the World Medical Association in 1954, and again by the Association's Declaration of Helsinki in 1964. Torture was expressly censured in the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. There were follow-up pronouncements in 1975, Declaration of Tokyo, and 1982, United Nations, the Principles of Medical Ethics. How is it possible for CSC and its agents in the past and now not to have known any of this information? Now, one of the defenses that CSC throws out there is the standard of the times. Back then, well, we weren't living in medieval days back then. There were tens of thousands of psychiatrists that wouldn't have touched that experiment with a 10-foot pole, and other researchers. You see? So back then is not like, back when? I'm still alive. So how far back could it be? You know? Everything was in place. They violated everything. So much of it was in place before I and other inmates were experimented on. Now remember when I first took them on, I thought I was the only one. I didn't know there were other people. And then when the investigation started, we found out that there were other women, 23 with my group. And then there were 30 on deck, but we don't know yet whether they were experimented on or not. And hundreds of men, maybe even thousands of men. And here's the race card. when I first thought it was me, said, oh, they're picking on me because I'm black, or I'm, you know, Native, da-da-da. Well, I found out that out of the 23 women, well, when we first found out that there were 23 women, like my lawyers and all of us, we found out, I thought, well, we can't play that race card now because there's 23 other women, right? Well, we didn't know that these white women were Jewish women. You see? So we had women of color. I was one. There was another woman of color. There was a Chinese woman. And the rest were Jewish women. And the one Anglo woman was mentally ill. And obviously mentally ill. And I remember her. Can you get your head around experimenting on Jewish women in 1960? These women were 20 years, perhaps my senior. They must have come out of the camps. Or they must have had people that have come out of the camps. Can you get your mind around this government doing that to Jewish women? I mean, I almost will say, to hell with me. But I mean, Jewish women, to experiment on them, medically experiment on them, given their history, given the very code that they're breaking, the Nuremberg code that came out of the Nuremberg trials? Too much, isn't it? Canada is so guilty of Nazi-style medicine. In Canada, the specter of forcible sterilization loomed as late as 1986. I'm getting on a roll? Coincidentally, a medical practitioner was found guilty by the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons after he hired two men to beat someone up and oversaw the administration of certain drugs to the victim. And that was in the Globe and Mail, Toronto, October 24th and December 13th, 1986. You can get it in any library. See it? Sorry. October 24th and December 13th, 1986. And look under sterilization. And that's the Globe and Mail, Toronto. CSC also violated their own Penitentiary Act, along with the Hippocratic Oath and other acts, policies, accords, and laws. Now, why would CSC need to be advised with respect to ethical issues? I don't know about you, but it scares me to think by their own admission that they, CSC, would seek outside help to tell them if it's ethical or not to administer LSD-25, a powerful hallucinogen, 100 times more potent for a given dose than psilocybin and 4,000 times more potent than mescaline. Adverse, and remember, this is clinical LSD. This is not recreational LSD. This is the good, the pure stuff. Adverse responses to the use of LSD-25 are also much more likely when the individual is unaware that they have been given the drug. And the resulting nightmares, bad trips, flashbacks, psychotic illnesses, and dangerous behavior are indeed too unpredictable and too devastating to justify this form of experimentation with the human mind. By the way, did you know that CSC is a funding partner for the McGill Center for Medicine, Ethics, and Law? I will now give you a few examples of the damage that LSD has done. Now, I know you're going to laugh. I laughed when I read this, so don't be embarrassed if you laugh, because it's macabre stuff here. Dr. Duke D. Fisher, psychiatric resident at UCLA's Neuropsychiatric Institute in the late 60s, tells of one case he attempted to treat. A Los Angeles man who took LSD 7 times and then became convinced that he was an orange. He locked himself in his room, Dr. Fisher says, and refused to leave it for fear that if someone touched him, he'd become orange juice. Imagine what kind of psychotic state he'd be in. He also refused to let Dr. Fisher treat him. This man is totally and perhaps permanently psychotic, but like thousands of other poor creatures wandering around in a dazed condition, his case will never be reported and he may never be treated. His friends bring food to the orange man's room and they look after his basic needs. Now this was in the 60s. I'd sure like to know what happened to that orange man. Maybe someday we can do some research. According to Dr. J. Thomas Ungerleiter, a psychiatrist specializing in LSD cases at the University of California at Los Angeles, also in the 60s, said that this is the most dangerous drug to come down the pike in a long, long time. LSD is also the prime suspect in chromosomal abnormalities. That seems to be identical to the one seen only in the first irreversible stages of a very rare leukemia. When we filed our lawsuit, we focused on LSD 25, electric convulsive therapy, and sensory deprivation. We didn't know what we know now. So that was like 3 years ago when we filed the formal lawsuit. So we had what I'm telling you, but I have been doing research. I live in the archives. And I was going through my prison files one day, because it's a lot to go through. And it's very disturbing to see how people spin your information on paper. And but I kept coming across, and you know, a lot of stuff is handwritten, you can hardly read it, so you just put it aside and you ignore it because you're trying to get to the stuff that you can read. And I kept going back to this one page, and I kept going, there's something, there's a drug here, you know, but I couldn't make it out. So I went to E-Fry. I said, Kim, let me use your photocopier. She said, okay. And I enhanced it, and I enhanced it, and I enhanced it, and I brought it right up till I could read it. The drug was chloramycetin. Not an antipsychotic drug, an antibiotic. Chloramycetin, an antibiotic employed against typhoid fever, may cause the destruction of bone marrow, severe anemia, and cardiovascular collapse, leading to death. Drug monitoring in the Netherlands, it included a table of the most serious drug-induced diseases in the past 100 years, the 20th century. 1938, alexithymia, that was the one that Velma, they gave Velma. And 1952, chloramycetin, and in 1961, thalidomide. The same Abel Watkins, a country doctor in a small town near Pasadena, California, watched his 10-year-old son, James, die slowly and painfully from the blood disorder aplastic anemia. The death was all the more horrifying because Watkins believed he had inadvertently caused it by treating his son repeatedly with a new popular therapeutically important antibiotic being marketed exclusively by one of the world's largest and most reputable drug houses, Michigan-based Park Davis. Park Davis was a pharmaceutical company that did contracts with prisons and had labs right in prison, on prison grounds in the States, experimenting on prisoners. The drug was chloramycetin. Watkins' regular Park Davis detail man told him that the drug had been used safely by millions of people during its 2 years on the market and that it had clear advantages over the sulfur drugs, penicillin, and even the new tetracyclines. It didn't have any of the side effects, like death, those drugs had, the detail man said, and infectious organisms didn't seem to have developed any resistance to it. So Watkins hadn't worried about using it on his son 3 times in 2 years to treat a recurring post-operative infection. It was only when his son was nearing death that Watkins began to hear about other cases of aplastic anemia associated with chloramycetin. He convinced one of his patients, an aviation writer for the Los Angeles Times, to do a story about this. Watkins and two other bereaved families he met through the article sued the drug company, which quickly settled. The Watkins family got $15,000, an enormous amount of money for a settlement at that time. They gave the money to their church. Abe Watkins' efforts set off an investigation by the FDA that in some ways has never really ended. Yes, the label was changed, and yes, Park Davis was unable to really overcome the negative publicity caused by its unflinching support of a drug that still causes many doctors to flinch. But chloramycin remains available for sale today. Although it has been eclipsed by other antibiotics in industrialized nations, it is still widely used in less developed countries and remains one of the most effective treatments for typhus. Why were they giving it to me? I didn't have typhus. I didn't have any of this stuff. Experimenting on me way after this drug was banned. Experts would later estimate, and I could have gotten any of these drug-caused diseases. Experts would later estimate that in the United States, chloramycin, and don't let America and United States fool you, because when it comes to this and pharmaceutical companies and experimentation, they were all in bed together. Okay, there were no borders here. Would have been appropriately prescribed for about 200,000 patients a year, whose serious infections would warrant its increased risk of serious adverse reactions. Now, I'm not going to go on there. I think you've got the picture. Now, if anyone can remember, I'm looking around here to see, I think I'm the oldest one in the room. In the 50s, late 50s. Oh, thanks. Late 50s. Children were dropping like flies from leukemia. And they weren't people that just had leukemia or who developed leukemia. And so they found out that chloramycin was causing the leukemia, and these children were dying from it. And so now they want to, I guess Park Davis wanted to know, well, what's wrong with our drug, and let's test it on a controlled environment. If patients knew that even one capsule of chloramycin could cause irreversible destruction of all their bone marrow or could cause leukemia, do you think they would willingly take the drug? Now, I've got, what have we found about four hits of chloramycin, four times that they gave it to me. We haven't gone through the whole thing yet, but we're still looking. And the reason for it on the medical thing is that I had a, it says on the left-hand side of the paper, hospitalized if necessary. On the right side of the paper, it says the chloramycin and the dosage, and above it, it says 2 sitz baths or 3 sitz baths a day, which tells me I had some female infection of some kind, which one has in prison because of inferior sanitary supplies, toilet paper, and soap. But you don't give chloramycin for it. I mean, there's penicillin, you know. Sales of chloramycin go up. And in 1976, doctors wrote over 500,000 prescriptions for the drug. And this Dr. Keith Allen Lasko says, I remember a child dying of aplastic anemia after a general practitioner had prescribed chloramycin for a cold, he says with exclamation marks. The parents were crying, the kid was bleeding. I was warned by several physicians that grave consequences would befall me if I told the parents that their beautiful child was dying because of a doctor's mindless prescription. Despite his glamour, his ego, and his delusions of grandeur, the surgeon unmasked is just another wealthy fellow with dollar signs for eyes. Despite the public's adoration of him, the surgeon turns out to be not so smart after all. In real life, he is merely a technician and really not much different from other craftsmen such as wood carvers and sculptors, or from skilled tradesmen like morticians and butchers. Okay, how are we doing for time? Hmm? Oh my God.
Yeah, go down.
10 minutes up. Okay, well, I just want to touch a little bit. Oh my God. You need hours. Okay, this is, I've got writing on the back. Lynn, I faxed this to you, and I dug it out because I wanted to read this, and I've got here, Lynn, fax me something. Dorothy, after, put your phone back on. Remember, I was using this, God, the circle. Anyway, yeah. And anyway, I want to read this. This is, you heard Kathy talk about Dr. L.P. Jeanrel, who was a psychiatrist, by the way, who was a deputy commissioner of penitentiaries when I was in and other women were in. This is a letter to him that I found in the archives. Dr. L.P. Jeanrel, deputy commissioner of penitentiaries, Department of Justice, Justice Building, Ottawa. Dear Dr. Jeanrel, dated May the 4th, 1948. This guy goes way back into human experimentation. As a matter of fact, he did it when he was in the military in 1939. I'm a good researcher. Here's the letter. Reference to the use of federal prisoners in scientific experiments, which I mentioned yesterday morning, turns out to have been in Wisconsin State Prison. The reference is as follows. The article is entitled, Observations on Riboflavin, Excretion by the Adult Male, and I can't say these names, by Hagdorn.
It looks like that. Hagdorn, Kiosk, Germick, and Servingus.
There you go. It was published in the Journal of Nutrition, Volume 19, Number 3, March 1945. The article on starvation, which was written by Servingus, I have been unable to find reference to. If I can discover anything further on it, I will send this over to you. There was, I believe, some highly confidential experiment, or rather research, carried on in Canada in connection with starvation during the war. It is likely that some general information about this could be obtained from Dr. O.M. Sullent, another player of ours, chairman of the Defense Research Board. And this is signed by Dr. Stoddill. So that's just a little letter just to show you, you know, how they were carrying on even way back then. Here's another one, 1968, and this is to Dr. Jeanrel as well. Dear Dr. Jeanrel, I'm writing to you on behalf of my colleague, Dr. M, and myself, for permission to conduct the, if you want the name, it's J-O-N-E-J-A. And myself for permission to conduct the following pilot research project in the maximum, medium, and minimum security institutions within the Kingston area. And this is what you were talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we don't need to do this.
This one, yeah. It's a different one. It was on the list, but I didn't talk about it. Do you want me to read it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We wish to study the karyotypes of 15 inmates in each of the Kingston, Collins Bay, and Joyceville farm annex. This, as you know, will only require us to take 10 cc of venous blood from the 15 volunteers in each institution. The actual karyotyping will be done in our own laboratory. We are moved to undertake this for two reasons. The first is because of our continuing interest in human genetic studies. And the second is because we can find no evidence that such a study has been previously done within the Canadian Penitentiary Service. Well, yeah, there's a reason to do it and not been done. European and U.S. investigations have been carried out, but we feel that your department would wish to have studies of this nature made on inmates of Canadian penitentiaries.
Okay.
Yeah. There was quite a lot of that research. Deal, yeah. That's when they took skin biopsies. Yeah. It was the same.
See, when someone in CSC...
Yeah.
This is 68. Oh, yeah. It goes back further. When someone in CSC, or any of the Justice Department, drinks a little bit too much, they're stressed. It's the stress of the job. You know, you need a mental health day, dear. But someone from my world drinks too much. We have faulty thinking, you see. When someone in CSC, and I'm not attacking any individuals, okay, but when someone in CSC commits adultery, well, you know, these things happen.
you know, da-da-da. And when someone like me commits adultery or has an affair with a married man or something, I'm a whore. Okay? Or I'm deviant, sexually deviant. You know, him. You know.
For sleeping with men, not
for sleeping. Stop it! There you go. There you go. I might try that on one day myself. I just know. But you see, this is how, you know, so who has the faulty thinking here? How can you even think that way? You know? And so we don't have a lot of time. I just want to tell you that I did discover this guy here. I have so many books. And I want you to know that I do not do research based on what I read out of one book. I get documents, I read 15, 20 books on the subject. So it's not, what I have here is not what I'm depending on for my research, okay? It's just what I brought. In 1914, Dr. Joseph Goldberger, he went to the governor of Mississippi and asked for human volunteers, 12 convicts from the Rankin prison farm, where that disease you were talking about, pellagra, had never attacked, were selected. If they survived the experiment, they were to be free. Now, you're going to have lunch, and I'm not going to tell you about this experiment. But if you want to read it, it's here on page 477. It's awful. Especially what the scientist himself does to himself. I mean, because these guys did to themselves, too, and what he did is to... I don't even want to go there. Anyway, okay.
You read it. Yeah, thanks, Dorothy.
Now, okay. All right. So I'm just going to finish. Have I got time to finish two pages?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to finish. Okay. June 8, 1961, Jane Doe, a prisoner at P4W, was administered a dose of LSD 42 days after Dr. Scott and Mr. Everson first observed the process. 42 days, one demonstration. No one could prepare for such a serious medical experiment in that time frame. It certainly would not be enough time to inform and prepare the subject for such a radical procedure. Jane Doe did not have a good experience. She was hospitalized for 5 days without one visit from Mr. Everson or Dr. Scott and was not approached again because her reaction was so bad that they wanted to wash their hands of her. Kathy interviewed both Jane Doe.
Yes,
Jane Doe is now in her late 70s and has lived a mostly distressful life as a result of the prison experiments as she relives her LSD experience over and over again and daily. At least I don't flash daily. Otherwise I couldn't be here.
Can I just say, mm-hmm. In the interview she said, it ruined my soul.
Mm-hmm. The first investigators, the board, established that LSD was used in a reformatory in the eastern U.S. prisons and do not believe it was used elsewhere in Canadian prisons at this time. I do have a problem with the lack of research skills, now that I'm a master researcher, that is reflected throughout the report. How is it possible for a criminologist and a clinical psychologist not to have come upon the countless books, articles, documentaries, theses, and word of mouth regarding the subject of prison experimentation in Canada and the U.S. Many of the articles published in journals are by their own colleagues. They certainly didn't have to depend on difficult-to-find corrections documents. And they also attended the same conferences and that sort of thing. As there is a wealth of information out there about LSD and prisoners in Canada, prisoners in the western provinces were given LSD within the same time frame that the board was investigating. I'm more than surprised at their attempt to minimize and neutralize their findings. It's obvious to me that critical research was not the order of the day, and all the second report did was trash their colleagues, the authors of the first report. Having a government department investigate itself has always left me feeling a little chilly. More than two decades ago, there was a public furor in the United States about prison experimentation in the 1960s. Federal prisons were fertile testing grounds for both U.S. and Canadian branches of large drug companies.
The 1973 book, Kind and Usual Punishment by Jessica Mitford. Is it kind and unusual or kind and usual?
Kind and unusual.
Unusual?
Yeah.
Okay. Kind and Unusual Punishment by Jessica Mitford focused public attention on the ethical dimensions of inmate testing. Academic investigators thought prisoners as useful subjects for exploring the nature of various addictions. The cluster of institutions in and around Kingston piqued the interest of several researchers at the same time I and other women and men were being used and abused by our government. Volumes of documents proved that hundreds of men were used as guinea pigs. How could these professionals, people in the know, not have any idea of what was going on in Canadian prisons? The clinical psychologist, one of the board members and investigators, worked at P4W in the late 1960s. If she herself was not involved in any of this mess, she certainly would have heard rumblings, as one does on one's job, unless you live under a rock. In the early 1960s, throughout the U.S., 3,000 inmates annually were being experimented on, pretty large numbers. If I had time, I'd tell you about it, because most of them were African-American men, which is a spin-off from the Tuskegee experiment. It is possible that Joe Lunchbucket from Main Street, Canada, wouldn't have a clue, but a clinical psychologist and a criminologist. This stuff is in their neighborhood. I'm sitting on thousands of pages of documentation about prison experiments, one case going back to 1939 in Canada. I understand that all the studies did not involve LSD, but I do know that critical research would have uncovered mind-altering experimentation. One of my LSD sessions was definitely at the Institute of Psychotherapy in Kingston. The first report said, quote, since according to both Ms. Proctor and Mr. Everson, remember he was the clinical psychologist, they stopped on the way back to the prison for women while inmate Proctor had a swim. Am I the only one who finds this action stopping for a swim extraordinary? I was under the influence of a mind-altering hallucinogen, LSD-25, a drug rated more powerful as psilocybin and mescaline. I was allowed to strip down to my underwear at the side of the road in front of the so-called professional man, one with good intentions, I keep hearing, and with his blessing, I dove into Lake Ontario. Mr. Everson had no way of knowing if I could swim, and I had no way of knowing if he could swim or swim well enough to rescue me if I found myself in trouble. And most importantly, would he have rescued me? I think the word reckless applies here. I find it interesting that in the early 1960s, a group of English physicians reported one patient attempted to strangle herself at the height of the LSD reaction, while three others have expressed urgent desires to go and throw themselves in the nearby river and had to be restrained from doing so. It was and is well known within the drug culture that LSD is considered a suicide drug, not because the patients or street users are suicidal by nature, but because while under the influence of this very toxic brain poison, they lose all touch with reality and are operating in an altered state. When I left P4W, I was 20 years old. I had $47 in my pocket, a one-way ticket to Montreal, and I was a full-blown drug addict, thanks to the government of Canada. I thank you.
Thank you.